Hello and welcome to Program Notes for your North Carolina Symphony, an exclusive production of the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm George Douglas. I'll be reading the program notes for all of the Classical Music Series concerts by the North Carolina Symphony for the 2018 and 19 season. The program notes I'm reading today are for performance by the North Carolina Symphony on the following dates: Thursday, November 15th at Memorial Hall, UNC Chapel Hill, and Friday and Saturday, November 16th and 17th in Maymandy Concert Hall, Duke Energy Center for the Performing Arts in Raleigh. This concert will be conducted by guest conductor Joshua Weilerstein. The featured guest performer will be pianist Michelle Kahn. The program on these performances will include the following. The symphony begins with the Leonora Overture, number 3, opus 72b, by Ludwig von Beethoven. And that will be followed by the Piano Concerto in One Movement, by Florence Price. Then, following the intermission, the symphony returns to the stage to perform the Symphony No. 6 in B minor, opus 74, often called the Pathetique Symphony, by Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky. Now I'll begin reading the symphony notes for this performance. I'll begin with some biographical information about our special guests. Joshua Weilerstein is the artistic director of the Orchestra de Chambre de Lausanne and has conducted extensively in both Europe and America. His enthusiasm for a wide range of repertoire, including his support for programming works by living composers, is combined with an ambition to bring new audiences to the concert hall. When he appeared with the North Carolina Symphony in October of 2016, the News and Observer praised him as a major talent. In the past season, Weilerstein made his debut with the Bamberg Symphony, BBC Philharmonic, and West Australian Symphony Orchestra. He returned to the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, Vancouver Symphony, Naples Philharmonic, and the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, including its tour to the West Coast. In Europe, he worked with the Oslo Philharmonic, the Swedish Chamber Orchestra, Leyte Symphony Orchestra, Orchestra Philharmonique de Radio France, Royal Liverpool Philharmonic, the Netherlands Philharmonic Orchestra, and the Deutsche Kammerphilharmonie Bremen. On tour with the Orchestra de Chambre de Lausanne and tenor Juan Diego Flores, he gave performances in Berlin, Paris, Vienna, and Amsterdam. He also returned to Australia to conduct the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. Weilerstein's career was launched when he won the 2009 Malco competition. From 2011 to 2014, he served as assistant conductor of the New York Philharmonic. Weilerstein is committed to music education both on and off the podium and hosts a classical music podcast, Sticky Notes, for music lovers and casual listeners alike. He previously served as concertmaster of Discovery Ensemble, a Boston-based chamber orchestra dedicated to presenting classical music to inner-city schools. Weilerstein feels that it is essential to have open communication between the stage and the audience. He is accessible on social media for conversations about the future of classical music, programming, and the experience of concert going. Next, Michelle Kahn, the pianist, our special guest for this performance series. Concert pianist Michelle Kahn made her orchestral debut at age 14 and has since performed with orchestras, including the Florida Orchestra, New Jersey Symphony, and Knoxville Symphony Orchestra. Her performances in 2018 have included concerts with members of the Los Angeles Philharmonic as part of that orchestra's Green Umbrella series, both at Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles and on tour in London. In 2016, she performed the New York City premiere of the Concerto in One Movement by Florence Price, which will be heard in this series of the North Carolina Symphony Concerts. Hailing from a musical family in Avon Park, Florida, Kahn began the piano at age 7 and soon added organ, steel drums, trombone, tuba, and violin. Her primary focus on the piano earned top prizes in competitions, including the International Russian Piano Music Competition, the Blunt Young Artist National Competition, and the 2014 Weidman International Piano Competition. Ken received bachelor's and master's degree in piano performance from the Cleveland Institute of Music and received an artist diploma from the Curtis Institute of Music as well. Soon after, she was placed on the Curtis staff as collaborative staff pianist. Ken is also on the faculty of the Luzerne Music Center. Her summer festival appearances include the Taos Chamber Music Festival, Yellow Barn Chamber Music Festival, Perlman Music Program Chamber Music Festival, and most recently, Artist in Residence at Piano Fest in the Hamptons. During her time in Philadelphia, Ken has served as the choir director of two children's choruses in the El Sistema-inspired program Play on Philly. She's also the founder of a new program, Keys to Connect, which strives to strengthen the bond between parent and child through the shared study of piano. She served as one of three Curtis Institute of Music inaugural fellows of Artist Year. Through that one-year fellowship, Ken worked with local community partners to bring the arts to Philadelphia communities. Now, notes about the program. The North Carolina Symphony comes onto the stage to perform the Leonora Overture No. 3, Opus 72B, by Ludwig von Beethoven. Beethoven was born December 16, 1770, in Bonn, and he died March 26, 1827 in Vienna. This work was composed in 1806, and the first performance was March 29, 1806, in Vienna. Ignaz von Seifried was the conductor. Now here is the overview. The decade, 1804 to 1814, that Beethoven devoted to his only opera, Fidelio, was an unprecedented amount of time to spend perfecting such a work during the early 19th century. Given the same 10 years, Rossini dispensed 31 operas between 1810 and 1820, and Donizetti cranked out 35 specimens of the genre from 1827 to 1837. Even Mozart launched 7 operas during his decade in Vienna. For Beethoven, however, Fidelio was more than just a mere theatrical diversion. It was his philosophy set to music. This story of the triumph of justice over tyranny, of love over inhumanity, was a document of his faith. To present such grandiose beliefs in a work that would not fully serve them was unthinkable, and so Beethoven hammered and rewrote and changed until he was satisfied. In his book, The Interior Beethoven, Irving Culloden wrote, as tended to be the lifelong case with Beethoven, the overriding consideration remained achievement of the objective. How long it might take or how much effort might be required was not merely incidental. Such consideration was all but non-existent. The most visible remnants of Beethoven's extensive revisions are the 4 overtures he composed. The only instance in the history of music in which a composer generated so many curtain raisers for a single opera. The first version of the opera, written between January 1804 and early autumn 1805, was initially titled Leonora, after the heroine who courageously rescues her husband from his wrongful incarceration. For that production, Beethoven wrote the overture in C major, now known as Leonora No. 1, utilizing themes from the opera. The composer's friend and early biographer, Anton Schindler, recorded that Beethoven rejected that first attempt after hearing it privately performed at Prince Linowski's palace before the premiere. Another theory, supported by recent detailed examination of the paper on which the sketches for the piece were made, holds that this work was written in 1806 and 1807 for a projected performance of the opera in Prague, which never took place, thus making Leonora No. 1 the third of the Fidelio overtures. Well, he composed a second overture in C major, Leonora No. 2, and that piece was used at the first performance on November 20, 1805. The management of Vienna's Theater an der Wien, site of the premiere, insisted on changing the opera's name from Leonora to Fidelio to avoid confusion with Ferdinand Peer's Leonora. The opera foundered. Not only was the audience largely populated by French officers of Napoleon's army, which had invaded Vienna exactly 1 week earlier, unsympathetic, but also there were problems in Fidelio's dramatic structure. Beethoven was encouraged by his aristocratic supporters to rework the opera and present it again. That second version, for which the magnificent Leonora Overture No. 3 was written, was presented in Vienna on March 29, 1806, but met with only slightly more acclaim than its predecessor. In 1814, some members of the court theater approached Beethoven, by then Europe's most famous composer, about reviving Fidelio. The idealistic subject of the opera had never been far from his thoughts, and he agreed to do the project. The libretto was revised yet again, and Beethoven rewrote all the numbers in the opera and changed their order to enhance the work's dramatic impact. The new Fidelio overture, the fourth he composed for his opera, was among the revisions. Beethoven realized that the earlier overtures, especially the Leonora No. 3, simply overwhelmed what followed. As a curtain raiser, it almost made the raising of the curtain superfluous, judged Irvin Colandine. And, from a technical viewpoint, were in the wrong tonality to match the revised beginning of the opera. The compact Fidelio overture in E major is now always heard to open the opera. The Leonora No. 3 often appears between the two scenes of Act II, a practice instituted by Otto Nicolai when he produced Fidelio in Vienna in the early 1840s. Both are regular entries on concert programs. Now, here's what to listen for. The Leonora No. 3 is one of the most magnificent overtures in the orchestral literature. It distills the essential dramatic progression of the opera into purely musical terms. The triumph of good over evil, the movement from darkness to light, from subjugation to freedom, is integral to this music. It is a musical, philosophical road Beethoven also traveled in his fifth and ninth symphonies, and in this sweeping overture, it is compressed into a tonal document of staggering power. The structure of the overture follows the basic sonata allegro design, but adapted by Beethoven to fit the dramatic requirements of his subject. It begins with a broad, slow introduction by turns lugubrious and threatening, during which the clarinets and bassoons intone the opening phrases of the aria Florestan sings in his dungeon prison. In a faster tempo, the violins present the arc-shaped main theme, which grows to a riveting climax before the entry of the complementary theme, a lyrical strain introduced quietly by flute and violins. The development section is filled with sudden dynamic changes and expressive harmonic excursions that mirror the perilous struggles of the play. Then, in an unforgettable coup de theater, a distant trumpet call signals deliverance for Florestan and his faithful Leonora. The recapitulation of the themes glows in triumph. A jubilant coda begun with whirling scales in the strings brings this superb work to a stirring close. The Leonora No. 3 was designed for two flutes, two oboes, two clarinets, two bassoons, four horns, two trumpets, three trombones, timpani, and strings. Next on the program, the North Carolina Symphony performs the piano concerto in one movement, this one featuring guest pianist Michelle Kahn, and this was composed by Florence B. Price. Price was born April 9, 1887 in Little Rock, Arkansas, and died June 3, 1953 in Chicago. This work was composed in 1933 and 34, reconstructed 2011 by Trevor Weston, who was born in 1967, by the way, and the first performance was June 24, 1934, in Chicago, with the composer as the soloist. Now, here is the overview. Florence B. Price was a musical pioneer, one of the first African-American students to graduate from the New England Conservatory of Music, the first African-American woman to have a symphonic work performed by a major American orchestra, the first winner of the composition contest sponsored by the Progressive Wanamaker Foundation. Florence Beatrice Smith was born in 1887 into the prosperous and cultured family of a dentist in Little Rock, Arkansas, and received her first piano lessons from her mother, a schoolteacher and singer. Florence first played in public when she was four. She later also took up organ and violin, and at age 14 was admitted to the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston, where she studied with George Chadwick and Frederick Converse, two of their generation's leading composers, wrote her first string trio and a symphony, now lost, and graduated in 1907 with honors for both an artist diploma in organ and a teaching certificate. She returned to Arkansas, where she taught at Arkadelphia Academy and Shorter College, before being appointed music department chair at Clark University in Atlanta in 1910. She returned to Little Rock 2 years later to marry attorney Thomas J. Price and left classroom teaching to devote herself to raising two daughters, giving private instruction in violin, organ, and piano, as well as composing. In 1927, following racial unrest in Arkansas that included a lynching, the Price family moved to Chicago. Florence studied composition, orchestration, organ, languages, and liberal arts at various schools with several of the city's leading musicians and teachers, and published four pieces for piano soon after settling there. She was also a frequent guest at the home of physician Dr. Monroe Alpheus Majors and organist and music teacher Estelle C. Bonds, and became both friend and teacher to their gifted daughter, Margaret. In 1932, Price and Bonds, then just 19, won respectively first and second prize in the Wanamaker Foundation Composition Competition. Price for her symphony in E minor and piano sonata, and Bonds for her song Sea Ghost. The performance of Price's symphony on June 15, 1933, by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Frederick Stock, was the first by a major American orchestra of a symphonic work by an African-American woman. The CSO repeated the performance at the Chicago World's Fair later that year. She continued to compose prolifically three more symphonies and two more piano concertos, a violin concerto, chamber, piano, and organ pieces, songs, spiritual arrangements, jingles for radio commercials, and received numerous performances. Her arrangement of the spiritual My Soul's Been Anchored in the Lord was chosen by Marian Anderson to close her historic concert at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. on April 9, 1939. Florence Price died in Chicago on June 3, 1953. Price was encouraged by Frederick Stock, conductor of the remarkably successful premiere of her symphony in E minor, to write a piano concerto and appeared as soloist in its first performance. She began the work in October 1933, finished the score the following spring, and gave its premiere on June 24, 1934, at a concert celebrating the 67th commencement of the Chicago Musical College, where Price was then a graduate graduate student with the school's orchestra. She scored another success with the concerto, which, according to a reviewer for the Chicago Tribune, aside from its technical perfections, disclosed thematic substance rich in syncopated and spiritual colors. And 2 months later, she played the piece in a two-piano arrangement at the annual convention of the National Association of Negro Musicians in Pittsburgh. It was heard again on October 12, 1934, when her protege Margaret Bonds was soloist in performance with the Women's Symphony Orchestra of Chicago at the city's Century Progress Exhibition. Now, there were apparently no further performances of the concerto in its original orchestral form during the composer's lifetime. The full orchestral score was lost, but the music survived in manuscripts of the solo part with an orchestral reduction. Arrangements for two and three pianos and a partial set of parts for the instruments. Those materials came into the archives of the Center for Black Music Research at Chicago's Columbia College, which commissioned composer and Drew University professor Trevor Weston to reconstruct the concerto's performance materials from them. Pianist Karen Walwin and conductor Leslie Dunner gave the first performance of Price's reconstructed piano concerto with the center's new Black Music Repertory Ensemble on February 17, 2011, and recorded it for Albany Records a month later. Now, here's what to listen for. Price's piano concerto is in a single movement divided into three distinct sections, moderato, adagio, allegretto, that approximate the scale and form of the traditional genre. The serious mood of the opening moderato is established by the wind instruments, which introduce the modally inflected motif that provides much of the thematic material for the first section. A piano cadenza leads to the entry of the full orchestra and further development of the modal motif. The moderato's emotional and thematic content are given formal balance by an episode based on a march-like melody in a brighter key. But the stern music soon resumes and leads to a full cadence and a brief pause. After a few transitional phrases in the strings, the poignant lyrical adagio begins with a call from the oboe, followed by a response from the piano, recalling a common structure in African-American folk music. The finale is based on the juba, an antebellum folk dance that involves foot tapping, hand clapping, and thigh slapping, all in precise rhythm. Such body sounds were a musical necessity since slaves were forbidden by their owners from having drums for fear they might use them to send coded signals. Price said that the rhythmic element in African American music is of preeminent importance. In the dance, it is a compelling, onward sweeping force that tolerates no interruption, a quality joyously manifested in the closing section of her piano concerto. This work is designed for solo piano, two flutes, two oboes, two clarinets, two bassoons, four horns, two trumpets, two trombones, timpani, percussion, and strings. Following the intermission, the North Carolina Symphony returns to the stage to perform the Symphony No. 6 in B minor, Opus 74, the Pathetique Symphony by Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky. Tchaikovsky was born May 7, 1840 in Votkinsk, Russia, and he died November 6, 1893 in St. Petersburg. This work was composed in 1893. The first performance was October 28, 1893 in St. Petersburg, and it was conducted by the composer. Here is the overview. Tchaikovsky died in 1893 at the age of only 53. His death was long attributed to the accidental drinking of a glass of unboiled water during a cholera outbreak, But that theory has been questioned in recent years with the alternate explanation that he was forced to take his own life because of a homosexual liaison with the underage son of a noble family. Though the manner of Tchaikovsky's death is incidental to the place of his Sixth Symphony in music history, the fact of it is not. Tchaikovsky conducted his B minor symphony for the first time only a week before his death. It was given a cool reception by musicians and public, and his frustration was multiplied when discussion of the work was avoided by the guests at a dinner party following the concert. 3 days later, however, his mood seemed brighter, and he told a friend that he was not yet ready to be snatched off by death, that snub-nosed horror I feel that I shall live a long time. He was wrong. The evidence of the manner of his death is not conclusive, but what is certain is the overwhelming grief and sense of loss felt by music lovers in Russia and abroad as the news of his passing spread. Memorial concerts were planned. One of the first was in St. Petersburg on November 18th, only 12 days after he died. Edward Napravnik conducted the Sixth Symphony on that occasion, and it was a resounding success. The pathetique was wafted by the winds of sorrow across the musical world and became and remains one of the most popular symphonies ever written, the quintessential expression of tragedy in music. In examining the Sixth Symphony, whether as a performer or a listener, care must be taken not to allow pathos to descend into bathos. It is virtually certain that Tchaikovsky was not anticipating his own death in this work. For most of 1893, his health and spirits were good. He was enjoying an international success, unprecedented for a Russian composer, and work on the new symphony was going well. He wrote to his nephew, Vladimir Davidov, in February that he was composing with such ardor that in less than 4 days I have completed the first movement, while the remainder is clearly outlined in my head. Tchaikovsky was pleased with the finished work. I give you my word of honor that never in my life have I been so contented, so proud, so happy in the knowledge that I have written a good piece, he told his publisher, Jurgensen, as soon as he had finished the score in August. The somber message of the music, therefore, seems not to have been a reflection of the moods and events of Tchaikovsky's last months. The music of the pathetique is a distillation of the strong residual strain of melancholy in Tchaikovsky's personality, rather than a mirror of his daily feelings and thoughts. Though he admitted there was a program for the symphony, he refused to reveal it. "Let him guess it who can," he told Vladimir Davidov. A cryptic note discovered years later among his sketches suggests that the first movement was all impulsive passion, the second, love, the third, disappointments, the fourth, death, the result of collapse. It is not clear, however, whether this precis applied to the finished version of the work or was merely a preliminary, perhaps never realized plan. That Tchaikovsky at one point considered the title tragic for the score gives sufficient indication of its prevailing emotional content. The title pathetique was suggested to Tchaikovsky by his elder brother Modest. In his biography of Peter, Modest recalled that they were sitting around a tea table one evening after the premiere, and the composer was unable to settle on an appropriate designation for the work before sending it to the publisher. The sobriquet pathetique popped into Modest's mind, and Tchaikovsky pounced on it immediately. "Splendid, Modi! Bravo! Pathetique it shall be!" This title has always been applied to the symphony, though the origin or the original Russian word carries a meaning closer to passionate or emotional than to the English pathetic. Now here's what to listen for. The symphony opens with a slow introduction dominated by the sepulchral intonation of the bassoon, whose melody in a faster tempo becomes the impetuous first theme of the exposition. Additional instruments are drawn into the symphonic argument until the brasses arrive to crown the movement's first climax. The tension subsides into silence before the yearning second theme appears, like a recollection of happiness in time of pain, according to American musicologist Edward Downes. The tempestuous development section, intricate, brilliant, and the most masterful thematic manipulation in Tchaikovsky's output, is launched by a mighty blast from the full orchestra. The recapitulation is more condensed, vibrantly scored, and intense in emotion than the exposition. The major tonality achieved with the second theme is maintained until the hymnal end of the movement. Tchaikovsky referred to the second movement as a scherzo, though its 5/4 meter gives it more the feeling of a waltz with a limp. The music's rhythmic novelty must have been remarkable in 1893, and the distinguished Viennese critic Edward Hanslick even suggested that it should be changed to 6/8 to avoid annoyance to performers and listeners. Charles O'Donnell, however, saw the irregular meter as essential to the movement's effect, as if its gaiety were constantly under constraint, directed not by careless joy, but by a determination to be joyful. The third movement is a boisterous march whose brilliant surface may conceal a deeper meaning. Tchaikovsky's biographer John Warwick wrote, "On the face of it, this is a sprightly march, yet it is barren, constructed out of bleak intervals, and for all the merriness of its manner, essentially empty, with a coldness at its heart." The tragedy of the finale is apparent immediately at the outset in its somber contrast to the whirling explosion of sound that ends the third movement. A profound emptiness pervades the finale, which maintains its slow tempo and mood of despair throughout. Banished completely are the joy and affirmation of the traditional symphonic finale, here replaced by a new emotional and structural concept that opened important expressive possibilities for 20th century composers. Olin Downs dubbed this movement a dirge, and just as there is no certainty about what happens to the soul when the funeral procession ends, so Tchaikovsky here leaves the question of existence forever hanging, unanswered, embodied in the mysterious dying close of the symphony. Wrote former Boston Symphony Orchestra program annotator Philip Hale, "The somber eloquence of the Pathetique, its pages of recollected joy fled forever, its wild gaiety quenched by the thought of the inevitable end, its mighty lamentations, these are overwhelming and shake the soul." The Pathetique Symphony by Tchaikovsky was designed for the piccolo, 3 flutes, 2 oboes, 2 clarinets, 2 bassoons, 4 horns, 2 trumpets, 3 trombones, tuba, timpani, percussion, and strings. These symphony notes were written and copyrighted in 2018 by Dr. Richard E. Rota. You've been listening to Program Notes for your North Carolina Symphony, an exclusive production of the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'll be reading all of the program notes from the classical music series of the North Carolina Symphony for the remainder of the 2018-2019 season. This program is available on demand as a podcast on the day before each concert series and will remain available for the rest of the concert season. I'm George Douglas. Thank you for joining me today. We sincerely hope that listening to Symphony Notes will enhance your enjoyment of your North Carolina Symphony. Goodbye until next time.